This week on Making Contact.
How long will it be before labor organizations who will not get rid of officers who are involved in anti-war activity lose their claims to protection? These are very dangerous times for us.
Under the pretext of national security, the Bush administration is undermining the rights of workers to organize collectively and removing vital worker protections, say many advocates of labor rights. From airline strikes to dock worker lockouts, the Bush administration has cited national security interests, ordering workers to return to their jobs, effectively neutralizing the power of a strike. U.S. officials have also opposed the rights of workers to unionize in new wings of the federal government, the Transportation Security Administration, and the Department of Homeland Security, arguing that union labor is not flexible in times of crisis. On this edition of Making Contact, we take a look at national security and labor rights. I'm Philip Babich, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program seeking to create connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. There are many images that we may recall from the moments and days immediately after the September 11th, 2001 terrorist attacks, ranging from horrifying to heroic. Among them are pictures of New York City firefighters rushing to the rescue at the site of the World Trade Center, many dying while trying to save others. It was a show of unity for many Americans to wear a t-shirt or a hat with the letters FDNY. President Bush was proud to have the battalion chief of the Fire Department of New York in the gallery during his joint address to Congress 9 days after the attacks. It may be interesting to reflect on Bush's reverence for the work of New York City firefighters, as his administration takes steps to make tens of thousands of jobs related to national security ineligible for union participation. Union work was at the heart of rescue efforts and emergency response teams after 9/11. The New York City Fire Department is affiliated with the International Association of Firefighters, a member of the AFL-CIO, and workers at the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, who coordinated response and recovery efforts, are members of the American Federation of Government Employees, the largest federal employee union. Nonetheless, jobs in the Transportation Security Administration, a wing of the U.S. Department of Transportation which will handle airport security, and the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, are non-union. David Bacon is a labor photojournalist and a contributor to The Nation magazine and Pacific News Service. He says that workers in the Department of Homeland Security will be denied basic labor rights.
The Bush administration, when it introduced its guidelines for creating this department, proposed that the civil security protections for workers in that department would be eliminated, saying that they were too restrictive on the authority of managers to move people around at will. Part of those civil service protections involve just basic rights on the job, things like the right to seniority and promotion, or rights to job transfers, or whistleblower protections, for instance, are also covered under civil service. And traditionally, they've been used in order to prevent patronage, the handing out of federal jobs as kind of like a plum or a gift from supervisors to their relatives. But significantly, one of the most important civil service protections that Bush proposed to do away with was that part of civil service regulations which makes it possible for federal workers to organize unions and to bargain with the federal government. And Bush essentially said that at the discretion, or really at the whim, of a manager of a department, that those rights of workers to join unions and to bargain could be just simply eliminated.
New citizenship requirements for baggage screeners at U.S. airports under the Transportation and Security Administration swept away thousands of jobs for legal residents. Jamie Gebben is the lead plaintiff in a lawsuit filed against U.S. Secretary of Transportation Norm Mineta on January 17, 2002. A legal U.S. resident, Gebben took a job as a baggage screener at Los Angeles International Airport after serving in the U.S. Army for 3 years.
I guess people need to know that there's a lot of immigrants that feel like they're citizens. I feel like I'm a U.S. citizen even though I wasn't born here because I've been raised here most of my life. I just feel that it's very important for American citizens to hear the voices of other people like me that are prior service and have served this country and this law is really unfair, knowing that there's a lot of service members out there fighting for this country, and when they come back home, they won't be able to have a job, for a federal job, because they are not citizens. And I just felt that it was my, I just felt like I needed to speak out about it.
The Bush administration got together with right-wing forces in Congress,
David Bacon,
and set up the Transportation Security Administration, and immediately moved to say that the people who do baggage screening in airports had to be citizens in order to do their jobs. That meant that thousands of workers across the country lost their jobs and essentially blamed the security screeners for 9/11, despite the fact that there's never been any accusation that security screeners permitted illegal or unauthorized objects to go through the screening checks at the time of the 9/11 incident itself. Everything that those hijackers carried aboard those airplanes were permitted items at that time.
Another way President Bush's national security drive has affected immigrant workers and union organizing has been through the Social Security Administration. According to David Bacon, the Social Security Administration has dramatically increased the number of letters it sends to employers when an employee's Social Security number doesn't match with the administration's database. This, says Bacon, can have the net result of firing a worker, sometimes enabling an employer to disable a union drive. Bacon says that Bush has invoked the national security argument in labor disputes that predate 9/11, including executive orders calling for airline workers to return to their jobs during strikes against Northwestern and United Airlines.
National security has provided a pretext, for instance, for busting the union for federal workers, creating a whole new department of the federal government without union rights, or for trying to weaken the longshore union in its negotiations with shipping companies, or for ordering airline employees back to work. All of these things have been done in the name of national security. But unless you construe national security so broadly that it really covers everything under the sun, these really don't have anything to do with national security at all.
What it has to do with, says Bacon, is a pro-business, anti-labor agenda. As an example, we now take a look at the labor dispute involving dock workers on the U.S. West Coast and the Pacific Maritime Association, the company that oversees labor agreements with about 11,000 members of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, the ILWU. On September 27, 2002, the Pacific Maritime Association announced that it was locking out ILWU workers at 29 West Coast ports, grinding to a halt cargo shipments. The association said it had done so because ILWU workers were staging work slowdowns. Prior to the lockout, the Bush administration had indicated that it was prepared to intervene by invoking the Taft-Hartley Act, which would require dock workers to return to their jobs. The administration had also said it would consider sending in National Guard troops, or the Navy, to keep the ports operating in the event of a work stoppage. Many observers say Bush's signals had undermined the ILWU's negotiating position, effectively neutralizing the threat of a strike. Citing reasons of national security, Bush invoked Taft-Hartley on October 8th, saying he could not continue to allow the labor dispute to hold up millions of dollars of cargo, including parts the military needed to fight the so-called war on terrorism. The next day, all 11,000 workers were forced back to their jobs under the old contract. Prior to the lockout, the ILWU organized a demonstration at the federal building in Oakland, California, to speak out against what was then President Bush's threat to intervene. Making Contact's Rosalind Fay was at the rally, and her report begins there.
On August 12, 2002, in Oakland, California, several hundred dock workers from the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, or ILWU, along with community supporters and workers from other unions, gathered outside the federal building to demonstrate against the Bush administration's threats to intervene in the contract negotiations. The day's events coincided with rallies and protests in every major city along the West Coast, including Vancouver, Washington, Seattle, Portland, San Francisco, Los Angeles, and San Diego. Hundreds of dock workers, donning traditional longshore caps and blue and gold jackets, waved American flags and joined in saying the Pledge of Allegiance, followed by speeches, and then chants of defiance against what they saw as the Bush administration's bias toward their employer, the Pacific Maritime Association.
I don't know what Bush been told.
I don't know what Bush been told.
This intervening talk is getting old.
This intervening talk is getting old.
I don't know just how you feel.
I don't know just how you feel.
Stay the hell out so we can make a deal.
Stay the hell out so we can make a deal.
Contract.
Richard Mead, president of ILWU Local 10, reminded the crowd of efforts in the past to charge that the labor movement was unpatriotic or traitorous.
We're here to send the Bush administration a clear message to get the hell out of our bargaining. Are the members of the ILWU terrorists because we took a stand during World War II against the internment of Japanese Americans? Are we terrorists because we boycotted Nazi ships prior to World War II?
No!
Were we terrorists in the 50s and the 60s when we wholeheartedly supported the civil rights movement?
No!
Did we breach national security when we supported the anti-apartheid movement?
No!
This is the ILWU's history, brothers and sisters. This is the history of longshoremen. We have freedom of speech. We'll not hesitate to speak out. We're here today because we have freedom of assembly and we have collective bargaining rights that we will not allow to be compromised.
On October 8th, the Bush administration invoked the Taft-Hartley Act, precisely the sort of federal intervention the dock workers opposed. The law, among other things, calls for an immediate 80-day cooling-off period where workers are forced back to work in the event of a strike. In this case, the Pacific Maritime Association had locked out the workers. Citing reasons of national security, Bush invoked Taft-Hartley, saying he could not continue to allow the labor dispute to hold up millions of dollars of cargo, including parts the military needed to fight the so-called war on terrorism. But Clarence Thomas, of ILWU Local 10, says the Bush administration's intervention in the dispute is part of a larger anti-labor agenda.
What we are facing here is a situation where, unfortunately, the Bush administration and the Pacific Maritime Association are using issues of national security, in particular the legislation that has come in the aftermath of 9/11, to basically go after unions. And we know that the issue of collective bargaining, union protection, union rights, have been questioned by the Bush administration because he sees those issues as being impediment to his program. We already know this with respect to his threats to veto any kind of changes to his Homeland Security bill because of the fact that that entails the movement of government workers from various departments into the Homeland Security Department. And we understand that he thinks that collective bargaining is going to be an impediment. We know that those sentiments not only are his with respect to government workers, but also to the ILWU and also other unions.
Priscilla Morello, a professor at Sarah Lawrence College in Bronxville, New York, says Bush's intervention could have implications for other labor disputes.
What Bush's move on behalf of the Pacific Maritime Association here has done is it's given the message to employers is we'll go the extra mile for you. The government will do more than we ever did in recent memory. We can put it on the fast track. We'll intervene on the fast track. Any union that won't just lick the hands of the employers will have the government on its throat.
Morello points out that certain provisions within the Taft-Hartley law, such as the non-communist affidavit clause, have been used in previous decades against labor unions to discredit and damage them. She warns provisions like that could be invoked in today's political climate.
Basically, the Taft-Hartley Act made illegal almost everything workers groups had done during the Great Depression to organize. All of their most successful tactics now became illegal. The Taft-Hartley Act states that all union officials above the level of shop steward have to file every year an affidavit stating that they are not communists. And if those affidavits are not filed, the union can lose all claim to protection under the National Labor Relations Board. Now, these days, to tell you the truth, they're rarely filed because it doesn't come up. But believe me, that provision was used to crush unions in the late 1940s, and it can be invoked again. How long will it be before we see anti-war organizations charged with giving aid and comfort to terrorism? How long will that be? How long will it be before labor organizations who will not get rid of officers who are involved in anti-war activity lose their claims to protection? These are very dangerous times for us. We've seen things like this happen before. And, you know, as a weapon against militant unionism, Taft-Hartley was and still is much more effective than goon squads and guns. When corporations use violence against labor, they look pretty bad in the public eye. But when they use law against labor, corporations can wrap themselves in the flag and put themselves forward as protectors of a society threatened by unions run amok.
Morello also says that it's important to recall the history of government repression during wartime.
I think this is going to be like the Cold War all over again. It already is, really, like the Cold War all over again. And you know something? These things happen, and they happen. You kind of, you look back in history, and these things are so clear, right? We can say, now the Cold War started in 1947 when Harry Truman announced the Truman Doctrine that U.S. foreign policy would henceforth be based on the containment of communism, and he instituted the loyalty program that same year, and Congress passed the Taft-Hartley Act that same year. Here's the beginning of the Cold War. But when it was happening, people did not say, oh, here's the beginning of the Cold War. It happens in pieces.
Morello points to the 1950s in the United States, sometimes referred to as the McCarthy period, when government officials took advantage of the communist hysteria to enact anti-union provisions.
In 1950, 11 unions were expelled from the Congress of Industrial Organization, basically for noncompliance with that non-communist affidavit provision and for criticizing U.S. foreign policy. Sound familiar? For criticizing U.S. foreign policy. Now, of those 11 unions that were expelled, two still exist. One is the United Electrical Workers, and one is the International Longshoremen and Warehousemen's Union, the West Coast Dockers Union. It has weathered the storm. It and the UE, the United Electrical Workers, managed to weather the storm. Others weren't so lucky. The United Public Workers, the National Union of Marine Cooks and Stewards, the International Fishermen, the Fur and Leather Workers Union, the Farm Equipment Workers Union, the Mine, Mill, and Smelter Workers Union, the Food and Tobacco Workers of America, the United Office and Professional Workers of America. These were all fatally wounded by the post-war, World War II onslaught against labor. But the ILWU and the UE survived. And I think it's important for folks to understand their history, to understand what they've survived, to understand what can, the kinds of brutal repression that can be invoked against labor, and to fight back.
Meanwhile, ILWU members, like Risa Collier, say that the protection of labor rights and worker benefits is a matter of survival for many dock workers and their families.
We need our benefits. I can't pay 40% of my dental or my medical, so I needed to come out here to protect my job and my livelihood and the future for my kids and what my other brothers and sisters fought for years ago. That's what I came for today.
The issue of worker safety is also a major concern. In the last year, five workers have been killed on the job. Lee Lynch is also with the ILWU Local 10. He speaks about the dangers on the docks.
It's real dangerous, but it's gotten a little better. I don't think there's too many small accidents, you know, where somebody just get hurt. Things are more serious now because the things that we used in the equipment is so large, you know, and these containers, they weigh 60,000, 70,000 pounds, you know, and hey, if something like that hits you or lands on you or whatever, you know, it either cuts something off or kills you. So, hey.
Lawrence Tebow, a member and former president of ILWU Local 10, says what it all comes down to is that the Pacific Maritime Association and shipping companies see the union as a barrier to free trade.
All of these shippers want the free flow of global cargo to come and go without any interference. And as a labor union, we're in that way of that. And they want to get us out of the way. So in the big picture, that's what this is all about. They want to put us in a position where we are not able to have a collective bargaining agreement with good terms and conditions and employment. We're not fools.
One of the retail associations that was pushing for the invocation of Taft-Hartley against the dock workers told reporters that the only reason they did this is these poor kids in the United States weren't going to have any Christmas presents under the Christmas tree because of the dock workers, and it was just time for the White House to step in to make sure that the little kids had Christmas.
Priscilla Morello.
Tell you something about those 10,000 dock workers. I've heard a lot of people say, well, why should 10,000 people be able to hold up the world economy? What this shows us is that 10,000 people made that world economy run. They were central to that world economy. And this is the power in the hands of working people. That's the power, that we make it run. And we deserve something for making it run. And what we deserve is not bayonets, and it is not Taft-Hartley, and it is not being pushed out into the cold, and now we're supposed to send our kids off to make a war. No, this is not what we deserve for making it run.
When I say you say night. You.
Night.
You.
Night.
When I say you say yon. You.
Yon.
You.
Yon.
When I say fight.
For Making Contact, I'm Rosalind Fay in Oakland, California.
We fight
together.
We fight
together.
You are listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you would like more information about the subject of this week's program, or if you would like to contact any of our guests, please give us a call. It's toll-free, 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. That's radioproject.org. Those who support the elimination of union rights for federal workers in the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and the Transportation Security Administration argue that unions may not be flexible in times of crisis. Therefore, they say, it's essential to centralize decision-making control. Labor journalist David Bacon says that this could actually impede national security efforts.
It puts all the power to do this kind of central command type moving of people around into the hands of people who are sometimes a long ways away from the workplace, so that rather than taking into account what the workers on the job themselves see as the needs, and sometimes their perception of what's needed is much more accurate because they're closer to the situation than people who are in Washington thousands of miles and many layers of the bureaucracy away. So it really sort of says to the workers who actually carry out the work, just do what we tell you to do. Don't think, don't speak out, don't say anything about it, just do what you're told. That's a kind of a recipe for an inefficient, bureaucracy-heavy kind of workforce, the very thing that we think that we're against, and in fact, the very thing that sort of works against the ability to respond effectively to emergencies. In fact, one of the key spokespeople of the American Federation of Government Employees is a woman who works for the Federal Emergency Management Agency and who made a point of saying, look, you know, we're very flexible. We respond very flexibly to all the needs that are going on here. The problem isn't flexibility. The problem is really management style. And that's the other problem. And that is that oftentimes the demand for flexibility is really a pretext. that's used by managers for instance, punishing people that they just simply dislike, or for discrimination, for instance. Civil service protections are also the protection against discrimination because you're a woman, or because you're black, or Asian, or because you're gay. All those protections essentially would be eliminated. Unions are important to federal workers because they're part of what ensures that managers have to play by the rules and that there's basic fundamental fairness in the workplace. And so by getting rid of that part of the civil service regulations that make it possible for unions to get organized and to bargain, essentially puts all of the decisions that govern how a person works and how they feel about their job and what their working conditions are like in the hands of managers. And of course, there are very good managers out there who are really honest people, but there are also people who misuse that power. And so it really removes the ability of people to protect themselves in a situation like that.
Bacon adds that for many leaders in organized labor, arguing against President Bush's national security rationale presents a dilemma. He says that many unions are saying national security interests are being unfairly applied, but not raising the fundamental question, what is national security?
In many ways, unions are very afraid of what's coming from the Bush administration, and workers are very afraid of what's coming because it seems so extreme and so anti-labor. And so on the one hand, there's been a tendency by some unions to say, well, we support the administration's goals around security. We just don't think that they're being applied fairly. For instance, around the creation of the Homeland Security Department, unions have tended to testify in Congress in such a way that more or less what they're saying is, well, yes, we agree that Homeland Security is an important issue and we need to beef up security. It's just that that doesn't have anything to do with civil service or with union rights. And of course, that's true. The problem with it is, though, that once you accept the use of national security in one area, it just sort of spills over everywhere. All of a sudden, it pops up in the longshore talks, or all of a sudden, it's used to justify immigration raids in airports during organizing drives and contract negotiations. And all of these things are done in the name of national security. So some unions are beginning to actually look at the national security argument itself and to try and answer the question of, is there a threat to national security? If so, where does it come from? What is the nature of this threat? And what does it have to do with basically taking out after unions? And especially when you see the administration protecting large corporations and, you know, turning over multi-million dollar contracts to companies that were headed by the vice president right before the election, and all of a sudden they're making money hand over fist by administering jails or building air bases. And this is all done in the name of national security while workers themselves are getting the blunt end of it.
And that's it for this edition of Making Contact, a look at worker rights and national security. Thanks for listening. If you would like more information about the subject of this week's program, or if you would like to get in touch with any of our guests, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. That's radioproject.org. Making Contact is an independent production. We're committed to providing a forum for voices and opinions not often heard in the mass media. If you have suggestions for future programs, we'd like to hear from you. Laura Levati is our acting executive director, Peggy Law, founding director, associate producer Amy Pomerlow, women's desk director Lisa Rudman, administrative coordinator Rosalind Fay, executive assistant Susanna Hines, senior advisor Norman Solomon, national producer David Barsamian, and I'm your host and managing producer Philip Babbage. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Until next time.